As we begin tonight, I want to thank all of you for returning for another Wednesday night. Last Wednesday night, I went on and on like Paul did, meeting where he talked a great deal, and time got away from me, and if there had been anybody sitting in the window, we would have had to praise the Lord that the windows weren't that far off the ground. Probably fallen out like Eutychus, but maybe he would have only gotten a slight bump instead of death. Let's turn in our Bibles to Job chapter 3 tonight. Third chapter of Job. And the moment that he speaks, after 7 days of being visited on an ash heap, no doubt outside the city, where he is scraping his tormented body with a potsherd, and where he has publicly identified himself as someone cast off. The text says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness cling it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept, then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold and filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? For there the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest, there the prisoners are at ease together and hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, and God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. I'm wondering how many people in the states of Kansas and Missouri and Tennessee and in the other locations where tornadoes have devastated not only individual homes but whole towns, and not only done great destruction but taken lives, could identify to a certain extent
with this lament tonight. I wonder if there are people in those states, even professing Christians, even devout Christians, who say tonight, why did I not die at birth? And why is life given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul? This is a passage that people are identifying with virtually every day of our lives. And I certainly appreciate the call to prayer by President Bush for those who have suffered. I always appreciate the careful way that he phrases theological things. You will note very carefully when he speaks of the departed and is talking about the dead, that he knows that not all people go to heaven, but he is hoping for God's grace for the departed. This is extremely unusual in a president of the United States. But of course, even he said, sometimes nature is tough. And that's exactly what we would expect by way of a secular comment. And yet, those like Job, who know the Lord, know that it wasn't just nature. It wasn't just the atmospheric conditions. And it wasn't just the particular weather patterns that produced the tornado that killed his children. And it wasn't just the matter of the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans who killed his servants and took his animals. And it has not been just a virus or just happenstance that has caused his skin to be so afflicted and has caused such suffering and such personal loathsomeness. Job is quite forthright. He knows that the Lord is the first cause. The Lord is the one behind it all. He said in the first chapter in verse 21, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. But if there is one thing that Job is not, he is not a Stoic. What's a Stoic? One who suffers in silence. Yes. One who suffers in silence. And not even so much suffering in silence. Yes. What attitude does the Stoic try to present?
Non-emotional denial.
Non-emotional denial.
Yes.
That this suffering is not reaching him. It is not affecting him. He is indifferent to it. This Job does not do. And this is one of the things that makes the book so incredibly effective, because Job says things that we all have said and that we can all imagine ourselves saying. And right now, he is in the position of a man who has been prosperous, and everything has gone against him. He has lost the children of his youth. He has lost his livestock and servants. He has lost his good health, and his wife has turned into a tempter, unknowingly saying the same words as Satan. And so here he is, one who has loved God and one who has served him, and now this God whom he loves has taken things away from him. And right now is when his faith is being tested. And that's when your faith and my faith is tested. When we know truth about God, and we know that he is good, And we know that he is compassionate, and we know that he is merciful, and yet he has permitted whatever we're going through. And as you well know from reading the first two chapters of Job, it has been actually more than a bare permission, because of course this couldn't have happened if God had not done what Satan challenged him to do, and that is put forth his hand by taking it away. He put forth his hand by taking it away. And so when Job speaks here, he says things that we can all relate to. He is speaking of the very fact that he exists, and he says that shouldn't even be. His sons and daughters were in the habit of celebrating their birthdays, and Job has no thoughts of celebration for his birthday. He says, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. In other words, do not allow the night to even be remembered when his father found out that his mother was pregnant. He says, let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. What is he saying there? How would you put it in your own words? Well, let's start small here. Have some of you gotten so old you want to quit having birthdays?
Yes.
Do you still want the day you even acknowledge that you were born?
Yes.
Are some of you May Day springers who are not letting any of us know it tonight for fear that we'll know that you have a birthday? We know you were born. We know that much. Well, what are you saying when you're saying, I'm so old, I don't want my birthday acknowledged anymore. I don't want there to be any party. I don't want any card. I don't want any greeting. I don't want a hymn at the church. I might want cake, but it's not going to be associated with my birthday. What are you saying? You don't want to be older, because to be older is to be
old.
It's to be old, that's true. And, closer to death.
Infirmities.
And what?
Infirmities.
Infirmities and so on. And these are thoughts that are making you miserable. And you don't want any particular commemoration of your birthday because it only adds to your misery. Well, Job is truly miserable. He is truly miserable in body and mind and spirit. And he is calling upon the very day that he was born to be cursed, the very news of his conception to be cursed. And he goes on to say in verse 6, that night let thick darkness seize it, let it not rejoice among the days of the year, let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren, let no joyful cry enter it. Let those cursed who curse the day, there were people in the ancient East who cursed days. And very often they were magicians and sorcerers and false prophets like the prophet Balaam, who was hired by the king of Moab to curse the Israelites. And the idea seems to be here that if soothsayers want to curse this day, the very people who would be willing and think they were able to rouse up Leviathan out of the sea, then let them go ahead and do it. We will meet Leviathan again in this book. Leviathan is a sea creature, and the description is very much like those that we know about prehistoric sea creatures, He's going to be revealed as one who can be tamed by God toward the end of the book. But right now, this is mostly figurative language, saying, let those who curse it, who curse the day, make it plural, days, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan, let the stars of its dawn be dark, let it hope the light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. That's essentially talking about the stages of a day coming, when the stars, before the day dawns, turn dark, verse 9, and then the light would be the actual daylight. The eyelids of the morning are the pre-dawn light before the sun actually rises. Let none of that happen for this day, he's saying in verse 10, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Basically, as we will see in a moment, Job is asking, why did I have to live to begin with? Why did I even have to exist? If I was going to live and all of this misery was going to happen to me, all of this sorrow and trouble, why did the whole sorry story ever get started? Why do I even exist? And this is one of the biggest questions that a lot of people have. As a Christian, even you will sometimes have to ask this question. Let me give you a couple of examples from Scripture of the kind of knowledge that can really comfort us. When God is calling us to do something, when God is laying it on our hearts that we need to adopt a particular course of action, say, for example, when he calls a person into the ministry, but also when he begins to impress upon you your chosen career, or he impresses upon you that this is the life mate that God has chosen for you, or he simply begins to make a path in your life clear. It's very, very comforting if you can know, as Jeremiah knew, that the Lord might say something like this, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. You remember that was part of Jeremiah's call in Jeremiah 1, 4, and 5. And even then, Jeremiah protested. He said, oh, Lord God, behold, I don't know how to speak. I'm only a youth, and so on. But why was the knowledge of God's sovereignty over his birth a comfort to Jeremiah? Why integrate God's specific knowledge of his birth and his specific plan for him with a call? And how would that make a call of God an extremely comforting and reassuring situation, even if you were scared, even if you were unsure, even if you were lacking in faith? How would that help?
He knew that God was with him. He wasn't a self-appointed prophet.
He wasn't a self-appointed prophet, and he knew that God had always been with him from the time that he was formed in the womb and even before. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. In other words, I had a plan before conception. All right? There's Jeremiah on the one hand. He's called of God, and he knows that he is the Lord's and has been and would be before he was even born. And that's one way that God's plan for our life is a great comfort. Then think about the Apostle Paul, where the Apostle Paul talks about how the Lord who called him from his mother's womb had ordained him to preach the gospel in Galatians. That he who had set me apart before I was born, who called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles. I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem, and so on. Here, you have someone who's embarked on a ministry that is successful. It's true, Paul runs into a few rocks occasionally. He gets stoned. He does get beaten. He goes through a whole catalog in 2 Corinthians about all of the sufferings that he has endured. But one of the things that he does see is God working through him as he preaches the gospel. And he can look back on his life and say, this is no accident. God set me apart before I was even born, and he called me by his grace. And that, of course, connects the love of God from before we were even born to the purpose that he has for him. So on the one hand, you've got somebody just starting out, like Jeremiah. He needs encouragement. You've got somebody like Paul, who has been successful and is looking back, and he sees the success as confirmation that God has in fact called him. But see, Job doesn't have any connection to make here like Jeremiah did or Paul did. Job thought that his life was in order. He thought that he had the approval of God. He knew that he had been blessed by God, and suddenly everything is absolutely taken away from him. Have you been watching the news as these people have faced the loss of their homes and faced the loss of their children? And have you empathized with them? Have you thought, could I go through that? Could I stand that? How would I feel? What would go through my mind? And what's going through Job's mind is that it's all so horrible. It's all so horrible that he doesn't even want to think about the day he was born. He wants to virtually consider himself as non-existent. And he is saying that the doors of his mother's womb should have been shut. He goes on to ask the question to which all of this is leading up in verse 11. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb, and expire? Why did the knees receive me to sit in my mother's lap? Or why the breasts that should nurse? This, we can well imagine, is what many people say in their hearts, if not in their mouths, when great disaster has befallen them and the life that they have known is completely taken away. Anybody have any comments so far about the first 10 verses? Anything that you've noticed or have a question about? Well, let's go on to the relief that he supposes is in death. Because if he died at birth, then here is what he believes would have happened in verse 13. For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth. Then he begins to describe various classes of people. And what he is saying, you will see, is that death is simply a relief. It is a chance to be at rest. It is a cessation of the things that one was doing before in one's life. And so he begins to speak with a certain amount of irony here in verse 14. With kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves. Who rebuilt ruins for themselves. What's he saying there? He's saying, well, they engaged in great construction projects to rebuild ruins. And obviously, the very ruins indicated that what had been built there before was subject to time and decay and futility.
And then here are the kings, and they come back, and they cease, they try to rebuild things. One of the things that was going on, and this is most relevant, is that Saddam Hussein was really trying to resurrect ancient Babylon. That was, of course, that site was near Baghdad. He was trying to be the latter-day Nebuchadnezzar. And he had done a tremendous amount of excavation of ancient Babylon's site, and he was going to try his best to restore it. This had the prophecy teachers excited, of course, because then we can have Babylon fallen for real in Revelation. But in any event, it didn't quite turn out that way, but that is exactly what Saddam Hussein was doing. He was building on the ruins of the previous despots of Iraq. Well, this is what's being said here, that these people had great plans, they did great things. The analogy goes on in the 15th verse, with princes who had gold and filled their houses with silver. So here were people who had great ambitions to be bigger and better than what had been before, and here were people who had the world's wealth, they had gold, they filled their houses with silver. And yet, here they are, all equalized. They're all equalized in the dust of death. Then he asks in verse 16, "Or why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light?" In other words, he's asking, why wasn't I simply born dead and then buried and hidden away as infants who never see the light? And then he begins to describe what happens in the state of death. There the wicked cease from troubling. They don't bother people anymore. They don't rob, steal, assault, and defraud people anymore. There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. Those who have borne the burden and the heat of the day, done hard work all their lives, are finally at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there. Doesn't matter what your status was on earth, it is appointed to man to die once, and after that comes judgment. The slave is free from his master. The slave will lie down with his master in the cemetery, Job is saying. Now, it's very easy to get sidetracked here, and one way we could get sidetracked is by talking about A, the Old Testament understanding of the state of death, which is called Sheol, the Hebrew word Sheol, and there's a big question as to how that should even be translated. Is that talking about a state of consciousness in a gloomy underworld, or is it simply talking about the grave? And there are arguments on both sides. Later on, Job will talk about Sheol, and he will compare that state to going down to the dust. And they found ossuaries, bone containers, just like the one they found probably of the Lord's brother James last year. And they've said Sheol. In other words, that's the state of death. That's the grave. And this is a subject for scholarly argument, but one thing that is for sure, and that is this: Job is not going any further with speculating about the state of the dead. Perhaps he doesn't even know about the state of the dead. We do believe in progressive revelation. We do believe that we as Christians know more about the state of the dead than the Old Testament saints did. But we do know this much, and this is what's important, that to those who are suffering, to those who spend night after night in wakefulness and pain and anxiety and misery, whether it's emotional pain, whether it's spiritual pain, whether it's physical pain, that death seems like a great relief. And that's Job's point. To die is to at least sleep, as Hamlet said. Hamlet was wrong when he said no more. It is considerably more than sleep. But it is at least to cease the activity that you have been doing here on earth. And this is what he longs for. He says, then I would have lain down and been quiet, verse 13. I would have slept, then I would have been at rest. In reading this, it is worth thinking about the fact that death is the great equalizer. The most democratic institution that God ever instituted was death, the state of death. And it comes to all. And the question will be, into what existence and into what state will we go when we pass from life into death? We know from the New Testament, of course, that we go into the presence of the Lord. Paul spoke of departing and being with Christ. We know that Jesus said to the thief on the cross, today you shall be with me in paradise. Some scholars say, no, you have to put a comma there. What Jesus meant to say was, I say to you today, comma, you will be with me in paradise. Well, anything I say to you tonight will be said tonight. And when Jesus said today to that thief, of course, he was saying it the day he said it. So it's kind of a ridiculous argument. What he was saying to the thief is, you don't have to await the resurrection to have a conscious state. Before this day ends, you're going to be with me in paradise. You're going to be with me in the presence of the Lord. And we know from his story of the rich man and Lazarus that the poor man died, poor Lazarus died, and the angels carried him to the side of Abraham. And we also know that in heaven, from the book of Hebrews and from the book of Revelation, that they are saints. They are. They do not have bodies as we do, but they are saints before the throne of God. But all of this belongs to future revelation, and none of this is what Job is concerned with. Job just wants peace. He has been assaulted in his heart and in his brain and in his body. And he simply wants the relief that can come only from death. Anybody have a comment here? An observation?
I've obviously never been in that state of mind to think like that.
Right.
But it sure does sound like somebody that's morbidly depressed. And I wonder if depressed people that contemplate suicide are not thinking just like that.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are. The interesting thing about that very point is that he doesn't go that far as to contemplate suicide. That he says it would be a relief, but there's no thought of actual suicide, arrogating to himself the role of God. That's right. But that would be precisely what they would think. And suicide, of course, would be a sinful response to just this state of mind. Any other observations about this so far? Is this something that any of you can identify with? Have you ever been such a state that you thought it would be preferable to die? Well, you probably don't want to hold up your hands. I have. I'll ask you to state your name and say that you've been in such a state that you wanted to die. Anyway, but this is the way that Job feels. And so you can understand it, and you can understand the grief of all of these families in the Midwest tonight that have just had their lives completely turned around, and Sunday's coming. And if there's a church left standing, they need to be there.
And what will the ministers sing? And what hymns will they choose? How will they praise the Lord this coming Sunday? Job goes on to ask in verse 20, why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? A couple of years ago, in 2001, it was the year before that, wasn't it? When one of our ladies in the church, Linda Cascarella, died, her husband, our deacon, Bob Cascarella, didn't want to live anymore. And what he could not believe is that he was 20 years older than his wife. And all of their lives together, they had planned on the obvious fact that she would outlive him. And they had made purchases, bought a second home up in Pennsylvania, and ordered all their finances. It was just a given thing that his wife would outlive him. And it didn't happen. He was the one who survived. And his question was verse 20. Why do I have to go on living? Why do I have to go on seeing light every morning? Why do I have to go on breathing? Why do I stay behind and live when there's just seemingly no reason? Why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter in soul? Don't you sometimes visit a nursing home and wonder, why do some of these people go on living? Why is it that they're alive? One of the hardest things I ever had to do, I suppose the first time I ever had to inform somebody of a death as a pastor, which is one of the very unhappy tasks that I have to do, was when I was chaplain at a nursing home. And I was in seminary, and I was informed by the nurse's desk that the son of a lady who was constantly bedridden and could barely do anything for herself, but this son had died. And so the nurse asked me, would you go down and tell her that your son has died? And the room was dark, and she was lying in the bed, and I went in and told her that her son, whom she had loved and brought up and delighted in, had died and gone to be with the Lord. And of course the question occurred to me, isn't it more in the nature of things that you should have gone first? You know, this is always the sad thing when parents lose children, because it's just a given. We think that children are going to outlive their parents, and younger wives are going to outlive their older husbands. But no, and when that happens, and when we're in misery, we ask, why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul? And we ask in verse 23, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? There's a question about what the phrase whose way is hidden means. The New Living Translation, which is particularly good in Job, and the translation was done by three Reformed Hebrew scholars, it paraphrases that question as, why is life given to those with no future? In other words, your future is hidden from you. It's not, your way is hidden from you. That's the idea. You can't imagine ever being any good to anybody again. You can't imagine ever being of any use to anybody. You are miserable. You have boundaries set about you. Perhaps you are infirm. You can't do anything anymore. Your light
my poor friend Mary, who can do very little except pray. She's either in bed or in a wheelchair, but she's a great prayer warrior. She can't even see to read her Bible anymore, but she can pray. And the question is, what do you do when there doesn't seem to be a future for you? You know how soon people begin to wither away and die after they retire. I've got an old uncle out in the hill country who's always worked on ranches, and he's always worked with animals and prepared fences and done all of the ranch chores. And I asked him recently, when are you going to retire? He said, I'm not going to retire. That's when people die. So apparently he's going to live forever. Big folks always move lots and shear goats. See, well, but there is truth to that, isn't there? Haven't you seen that in people? That they just kind of waste away. Why? They have no purpose for living that they know of. And that's what Job is talking about. My way is hidden. My future seems to be purposeless. But then, here's the ironic thing. Verse 23. He uses the words, whom God has hedged in. What does he mean by those words? Whom God has hedged in. God's got me trapped. God's got me trapped. I'll never get out of the four corners of this room. I'll never get out of this wheelchair. I'll never be what I was at one time. I'll never be what I wanted to be. And I've lost everything I have. I've lost my loved ones. My wife is showing that she does not have my best interests at heart. And I've been trapped, and he gives the credit to God. And God has hedged in. And he says, why do I have to have light? Why do I have to have life? Why do I have to even go on? What's ironic about his using this phrase, whom God has hedged in? Satan used it to mean something else, didn't he? He told God, have you not put a hedge around him? You've been protecting him. He's led too easy a life. You've been too soft on him. You've spoiled him. No wonder he loves you. No wonder he praises you. He's got everything. You've blessed him. It's really your fault, God. You've put the hedge around him. And now there's another kind of hedge around him. The first hedge is gone, but another hedge is coming. And Job feels like he's in God's trap. And he says, for my sighing comes instead of my bread. And that's hard to know what that means, and the commentators are divided. I'm going to guess that his state, his emotional state, is too wrought up for him to ever be able to eat. I think that's what it means.
I agree.
Huh?
Is that all right?
You what?
I agree.
Oh, good. Yes. We have agreement. And my groanings are poured out like water. Water pours very freely, doesn't it? And what Job is saying is, I groan constantly. I'm sighing and agitated and I can't eat. My groanings are poured out like water, easily, freely, constantly. And he says in verse 25, for the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. Now, a number of years ago, when the word faith movement began to take off, this was a passage that was quoted by those who said that you are, you have, and you receive what you confess. And if you make positive confessions, you'll get positive things. If you confess, for example, that you're not sick, even though you're coughing, then you're not really sick. And if you negatively confess, I'm afraid I'm going to get sick, your angel hears that and says, oh, well, I didn't quite catch that. I heard get sick, so that. There it is. And you get what you fear. You get what you negatively confess. You get what you positively confess. Utter, shallow, ridiculous drivel bears no resemblance whatsoever to Christianity or life. But guess what? This was the poster verse. The thing that I fear comes upon me. Apparently, Job had gone around fearing that his kids would die, fearing that his servants would be killed, fearing that his animals would be rustled, fearing that his wife would turn against him, and fearing that he'd break out in boils. And Job did all this to himself. What a comforting doctrine. But that was the idea. Job did all this to himself by fearing. And so the doctrine is, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but love, power, and sound mind. You are not to fear. And fear is a great sin. And Job did have a secret sin. Never mind that the first verse says he didn't. He did. And it was there in verse 25. The thing that I fear has come upon me. And what I dread befalls me. It probably should be translated in the present tense as well as rather than the past. Okay. Anybody have any comment about that? Is that what the text is saying? First of all, we only get one inkling of what Job had been afraid of in the text before this, in the chapters before this. What had he been afraid of?
His children would sin.
Yeah. His children would somehow sin and curse God in their hearts. Mm-hmm. So it would be perfectly legitimate exegetically to say, no, the only thing we know for sure that Job actually feared was that his children would curse God, and that's why he made all the sacrifices. And so if Job is thinking about any specific thing right here in verse 25, it would be only the death of his kids, because it was the death of his children that he so feared. And he would be having to conclude, and they did curse God, and they did bring this upon themselves. So that would be one way of explaining the verse. Yes, Blake?
Or rather the wrath of God. Or the lack of God's blessing towards them.
That's right. I think that it is the latter. What he has feared was losing the communion with and the understanding of God that he had. In other words, he is one like David, and I'm just going to use words from Psalm 51. I'm not going to use the connection with David's sin. But what did David fear after he had sinned with Bathsheba? Cast me not away from your presence, and take not your Holy Spirit from me. So here is Job fearing that God is clean gone from him, and he has somehow misunderstood God, and somehow God has become his enemy, and somehow there is this estrangement from God, and he doesn't know why, but he never wanted it to happen. That's what he feared. The thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. What does he mean? He's saying, instead of my resting, trouble comes. Those of you who have had sleepless nights when you've been in pain or been in agony of soul, you know what it's like to roll and toss, not be able to sleep. If you have a spouse, your spouse
says helpful things like, honey, be still. Or, honey, what's the matter? Be quiet, shut your eyes, shut your mouth. Try to get some sleep.
Can't you go sleep somewhere else?
That's right. Or can't you go sleep somewhere else? And when I go sleep somewhere else, and 2 hours later I hear a little Phoenix. What are you doing here? So anyway, when you're married, praise God that you're not permitted to be miserable. It is a blessing of the Lord. But have you ever been in this kind of misery? You have no rest, but trouble comes. Let me get your reaction to the whole chapter, then I want to read you the reaction of one of the world's great commentators. Anybody have any impressions you'd like to share with the rest of us? To me, it's a chapter that you just kind of put your hand over your mouth and say, this is awful, this is understandable, this is human, I can identify with this. Anybody have any comments? Okay, then let me read you a comment from a very great Bible scholar. To curse the day of our birth because then we entered upon the calamitous scene of life is to quarrel with our God of nature, to despise the dignity of our being, and to indulge a passion which our own calm and sober thoughts will make us ashamed of. Certainly there is no condition of life a man can be in this world, but he may be in it, if it's not his own fault, Certainly there is no condition of life a man may be in this world, but he may in it, if it is not his own fault. So honor God and work out his own salvation and make sure a happiness for himself in a better world. Then he will have no reason at all to wish he'd never been born, but a great deal of reason to say that he had his being to good purpose. What do you think of that comment? Let me ask this question. Is it true? It's true. It's true. So if it's true, is it appropriate? Were any of you kind of shocked when I read it and thought, this guy's being kind of hard on Job? You should have been. You should have been. Now, the comment is true. Then here's a comment on the comment. I'll tell you who made the comments in a moment. Here's a comment on the comment. Job's lament is foolish because it hopes for something that cannot be. It curses something the day of his birth that cannot be hurt. It asks for something that, were it possible to bring it to pass, would have been dreadful for Job's mother. He wished for something that would have brought her pain and suffering. And lastly, it despises the goodness of God in giving Job life and existence. You agree with that comment? Is it true? Some say no. Some are saying, some are nodding your head in a way that will go either way. What the answer is.
Well, sometimes I think you may feel something like that temporarily, but that doesn't make it true. It doesn't even mean that you really mean it, you know?
That's true. The first comment was by Matthew Henry, not ours, the old one, the one from the 17th century. And then the second comment was whoever wrote the comments on Job in Table Talk back in 1995. Now, let me tell you something about those comments. They are true. God has written in his book all the days of our lives. He did ordain that we should be born, and he ordained who our parents should be. He ordained the day of our birth as much as he ordains the day of our death. And yes, we would be cursing the provision of God, and all of those things are perfectly true. The problem is that you cannot administer that kind of judgment or that kind of advice too quickly. And that has to be eventually something that the sufferer begins to see. Let me give you an example. A number of years ago when I graduated from seminary, Barbara and I jumped in our Volkswagen microbus with the pump sink and the ice box that held large blocks of ice, and we got our Coleman stove and we took off to drive up to the Pacific Northwest. And so we drove and we drove and we drove. We went through Texas and New Mexico, Colorado and Utah, and then Idaho and on up through part of Oregon and on into Washington State. That's the first time I'd ever been to Washington State. A few years later, we flew to Washington State. And it was a very, very different experience to just go from Austin, and a few hours later, there we were in Seattle. What happened when we drove? Well, when we drove, first of all, we got a sense of the vast distance between Texas and Seattle. Just secondly, we got a sense of the changing scenery, and we saw the beauties of Colorado for the first time. And then we got on up there and crossed the waste-howling wildernesses of Utah and Idaho and even eastern Washington State. And then we got into the mountains and we saw Mount Rainier. And we camped below Mount Rainier. And we saw the magnificence of the scenery and saw that all the trees were twice as tall up there as they were in Colorado. And as breathtaking as the scenery was in Colorado, it was even more beautiful up there. And we had this sense of an accumulation of experience and a great distance that finally made us appreciate Washington State. But when we flew, well, it's like when you fly anywhere. You don't get that sense of perspective. And here's what I'm saying. What Matthew Henry wrote was true. And what this commentator wrote was true. But this is a premature, censorious, judgmental attitude on a suffering man that must be withheld until we enter into that man's suffering. And so all I want you to see is Matthew Henry and the writer here have a right to say what they're saying about someone complaining about things that God has ordained, like their birthday and their life. And yet at the same time, the Bible doesn't condemn Job for saying this. And I think that what we have to understand is that it's our job as readers of this book at this point to say, I'd like to try to enter into this man's world. There are a lot of people suffering out there that maybe I really don't empathize with. There are people undergoing tragedy and loss and horror and failure and just utter chaos up in these Midwestern states that I cannot identify with at all. And I think we need to fully understand Job's desire for death, or to even ask the question, why was I even born? And ultimately, yes, we can say, it ultimately doesn't do any good to deny that God has been in some way sovereign. And it ultimately doesn't do any good to not think of the state of Job's mother, who was no doubt very happy when he was born. Yes, all of those things are true, but we just can't say them too quickly. Yes, Greedy.
I remember that nice comment of J.I. Packard that a statement that's only partially true and partially untrue is not really a truth. A whole, you know, a half truth.
Yeah.
And a half distruth is still a distruth. That's why I said no with it, because the attitude is wrong. The censor is a lie. The content in that second comment, the attitude is a lie. It's a false attitude. And that's like that. You can't say it's a true statement, I don't think.
Well, actually, I think you can actually say that it is true. But like, I want to take the first point you made. It leaves out empathy and brotherhood and fellowship for the human condition.
Here's right.
That's the problem. Yeah, it just simply is saying this was sin. There's an end of it, and that's not what we are supposed to do when we comfort people in their misery. It is not what we want when we instead are the miserable ones and going through this kind of agony. What we need in this kind of situation is our merciful high priest, the one who, with loud cries and tears, offered up prayers to God, who was able to save him from death. This is one of the times when I particularly value the humanity of our Lord Jesus Christ, and very strongly cling to Hebrews 4:15, which says we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And then one comment here from Steve. Were you going
to? Actually, that was similar to what I was going to say. It's interesting that Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, kind of both like Job and unlike Job. In one sense, Jesus, having in a sense been stripped of all anything he called his own, and about to be stripped of even his life. And in one sense, he surpasses Job because he did not. He does say, "Thy will be done," but certainly we would have to say also that Jesus there does have a very real humanity like Job's. And Lord, Father, if at all possible, take the cup from him. And certainly if Jesus himself can say such words, we would be very remiss to out-God God.
That's right.
Say,
we're very remiss when we out-God God
on this matter.
I want to close by giving you, however, an analogous sort of moment from Jeremiah's book, Lamentations, and that is this moment, which I read to a suffering saint this week who's up all night in misery every night. And this was the state of Jeremiah as he bore the invasion of Judea and the of Judah and the sacking of Babylon. And in Lamentations chapter 3, he says in verse 16 about God, "He has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say my endurance has perished, so has my hope from the Lord. Remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and the gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him." We don't know when Job was written, but it may have been a story of a time when there were no written words of God. No written words of God to read and to know and to memorize and to fall back on. And whether it was or not, the point is that we do have written words of God. And we, when we go through these dark nights of the soul, can say the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. When we read that to a suffering saint, let us take into consideration the depth and the reality of their suffering. It may not be something that we can even identify with. We may just have to do with some of our suffering friends like we're doing with this third chapter. Just simply being stunned in silence at the depth of this misery. But we can still know that somehow above it all is the Lord, whose steadfast love never ceases.